This is Art House Radio, and it's episode 24. Oh, it's good to be back. Took a little time off, not by choice. Had some technical issues. Kind of had a terrible week at the beginning of last week. On Saturday, I dropped my camera in Detroit. That's not working still. And then my MacBook was... For those of you who are poor, a MacBook is basically the same as a laptop. I'm just kidding. I'm very poor. I think it's in the contract that you sign. You have to say MacBook instead of laptop just to make people hate you. Yeah, I'm not a fan of it, but, you know, I just want to be a rule follower, so I don't want to get in trouble. Anyway, I thought it was going to be toast, and it turns out it wasn't, so I'm back, and I can go resume my Art House Radio babies just popping out of me left and right. Sharing them with the world, and you, obviously. Not that you're not part of the world. I think you know what I mean. But I'm happy to tell you that the rest of my week last week was amazing. So, it was lovely. It was just lovely. And I'm not going to tell you anything about it, because I don't got to tell you shit. You don't own me. I'll share whatever I want with you. And that's not one of the things I'm going to share. I'm also not going to tell you what I'm having for dinner tonight. So, if that's a problem for you, then maybe this isn't working out. Maybe you should just go to another podcast, a food one, where they talk about it openly. Don't leave. Come on. Come on, baby. You know. No, baby, don't leave. You know. This is going to be a really good episode. I am talking with friend, composer, pun enthusiast, Jay Derderian. He is a composer based in Portland, Oregon. Beautiful city. And we talk about things sometimes. Music, the creative process, art, culture. Clearly, we're cultured and important people. And I thought, why not have an episode where we can talk about that stuff? And that's exactly what we did. And we sat down through the magic of technology in different geographical locations. And we just talked, and it was great. And, it's kind of a long conversation, so we'll go straight into it after I play one of his works. You know, this show is all about letting things be what they are, sound-wise. It seems like all the time we're given sound bites, and things are short, and our attention spans are very short, and our patience is short. We'll not hear. If that's what you're looking for, just press stop. Stop downloading this and fuck off somewhere else. Because on this show, in this podcast, while I'm running it, is going to be something that's just relaxed. And you want to think about things. And sometimes that takes 10 minutes. And it's not something that can be summed up in seconds always. Sometimes it can. Sometimes it can't. It has to be real. So, before we have the conversation with Jay, let's play a work of his. And it's about 10 minutes long. It's called Outside the Eyes. I think this recording, it's a live performance. I think it's in 2013 at Lincoln Hall at Portland State University in beautiful Portland, Oregon. And the performers, let me give credit, are from Third Angle. That's a new music ensemble in Portland. The violinists are Ron Blessinger and Gary Ewer. I hope I'm saying that right. Okay, I just want to interrupt myself for a second and say that it's Greg Ewer. Greg, with a G. There you go. All right, let's get back to it. The violist is Brian Quincy, and the cellist is Hamilton Heifetz. I hope I'm saying that right, too. That sounded a little too ethnic the way I said that. I don't know if I said that terribly or terribly well. One of the two. Anyway, let's do this. Let's listen to the piece. It's about 10 minutes. And then on the other side, a conversation with Jay Derderian. Enjoy.
Thank you.
He didn't really like to speak in front of people. I don't know if he likes to talk about his work. Usually if there's interviews with him in the past, it's kind of like at his house and he's just kind of in his kitchen. So maybe stage stuff gets to him. I don't know.
I couldn't tell you, but I mean, I noticed, you know, when he like had these questions about process that he seemed very withheld or withholden. I don't know what the right word is.
Yeah.
And you know, I could get that too, because it's such a tricky question to answer, you know, asking about how does an idea from, you know, from being a germ to becoming a full-fledged, you know, 40-minute piece for orchestra happen? It's like, no two composers are going to give you the same answer twice.
No.
And, you know, looking for any sort of, I don't know, magnificent insight might be a little bit tricky. But I guess, you know, talking about process is always fun too. It's, you know, always neat to walk around inside the head of someone like that, for example, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And like I was watching a David Bowie interview like last week, and he was talking about how he knew so many painters who titled their work after the work was finished. So he was like, that was a big clue as to, do they know where they're going? Or is the process just something that happens and they can't really explain it? And so if we ask composers or artists or whatever about their process, you probably get a different answer from the same composer in two different days.
Yeah.
I'm guessing.
Yeah. Yeah. I read online somewhere, he talked about, or maybe it was that interview, but he was talking about how he used to, at one point before he would actually write the material, he would come up with a roadmap. Like he was talking, you know, about formal schema, and he used to write that way for a number of years, but now he's since abandoned that kind of thought. I think it's, maybe he found it too restrictive, but it was an interesting shift from, you know, and I don't hear that often from other composers, that they go from such, you know, a formalized, rigorous process to something a little more almost intuitive. You know, I know like Rockbird had a big shift in his creative process, but that was, I believe, after his son died. So I think he had a little more emotional reason for doing so.
Yeah.
But, you know, he like went from the hardcore 12-tone serialist thing, and then after his son unfortunately passed, he switched to almost like a 19th century romantic language, stating that the cold process wasn't adequate enough to express his grief.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if something like that shifted in his process too, or his way of thinking, or even in his life, you know?
Yeah. It could be, sometimes like there are like revolutions in certain genres, like in art or in music, like conceptual art in the 60s, where they have all these great ideas and they're challenging the status quo. And after a while it dies because a revolution can't go on forever. So I wonder if like your own personal process follows those sort of patterns where you come up with this idea, you think serialism's great. You start finding this stuff that works. Like you always have tacos on Friday and that seems to work and you just get superstitious about it. And then after a while it just kind of stops and you have to adapt to whatever else is happening in life.
Yeah. I mean, you know, for Rockberg, it was a personal choice. I don't know. I can't speak to Burswell, but like for my own self too, you know, I spent so much time thinking about formalized structures, and I still do. You know, I have a piece for quartet that was extremely formal. But I think, you know, like so many things, like the revolutions, like what you were talking about, a lot of these are not only responses to personal crises, but social crises as well, or social contexts of any kind, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so what may cause somebody to switch from doing something hardcore serialized or hardcore process-based might be a way for their work to engage the dynamic conversation that's happening around them right now with other artists and in relation to what's happening in the, you know, around them, you know?
Yeah.
I think, George Frederick Haas had a piece about Eric Garner premiered pretty recently for solo trumpet. And, you know, he was someone who also, I think, made that switch from, and I'm not sure about this, I could be wrong, but he made that switch from formalized rigor structures to a more intuitive process where he just kind of let the music guide him through where he was going. You know, he didn't necessarily plan the middle or the ending. It just kind of happens. And so I'm wondering if so many of these kinds of shifts in the processes are in relation, like you said, kind of talking about, I forget where I'm going with this. It's in kind of response to what's happening around them, both internally and externally.
Yeah, definitely. It's almost like process is an organism on its own, and it lives and breathes, and it has these peaks and valleys, and you just sort of adapt to it. Almost like, Maybe like conducting a little bit. I haven't conducted a ton, but it's like if you,
yeah.
you've got that energy in front of you and you have to kind of know when to ride it and when to lay back and when to sort of guide it. So you're just, it's almost like you're interacting with the process itself. Like it's a separate being.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a dialogue, you know, I mean, cities and environments are changing around us all the time. You know, we were talking about this earlier about Detroit and Portland, about gentrification, you know,
right.
Portland is seeing a lot of change happening. You know, a lot of historical sites are being torn down for new condos and new renovations, you know, and it's such a double-edged sword. You know, we talk about how great it is to see our city flourish, but at the same time, we don't want to accommodate any people who might become interested in it, you know?
Yep.
And seeing, you know, that kind of change and everything too could definitely influence the way you might process your own work and the way you might change your own work, even and the way you might even, you know, react to your environment.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, especially if your city's changing so rapidly, like Portland has, and probably Detroit to a sort of a different tempo. But when you see that going up, like you were saying, Portland, you kind of want it to become a thriving place where it'd be great for Portland to have a music scene that, I mean, it does have a great music scene band wise. You know, there are tons of bands, and in terms of like contemporary classical or composers, it's definitely got a scene, but it would be interesting if it became, you know, something like you were saying, San Francisco or New York or something, but it would be its own thing. It would definitely have an effect on you, whatever you're writing, I would think.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, as people come here, you meet new people and the art scene and music scene develops and varies and, you know, new bands come and go, new composers come and go. And that in itself, you know, the kind of people that come here can also just affect the way the scene happens. You know, I mean, we've like Tetsu Kim is a guy who just moved here recently. He's a very great composer, does a lot of great work. And as soon as he got here, all the music ensembles responded. And they should, because his music is awesome.
Right.
You know, but it was such an interesting thing. Like there comes this person who had been outside of Portland for so long and immediately is woven into the fabric of the community, while there are also other composers here who have been for years and can hardly get a performance.
Yeah.
You know, and again, this is not against Tetsu. You know, he's a great guy and his music is awesome. I just thought it was a really interesting to see how quickly someone can become assimilated based on their own success versus people who may have been, you know, grinding it out for so long and may have not had the same opportunity. So
particularly if you've got people like, if you're in a city where there are more violinists and more pianists because they're coming there for whatever cultural reason, then that definitely helps a composer who's grinding it out acoustically. If they're composing, it's not necessarily computer music. It's not exclusively computer music. So if you need a string quartet or a flutist, then obviously that helps if your city grows and you have more opportunities with different ensembles or performers. So that would definitely help as well. Affect it.
Yeah. 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 It's like an organism, like you said. I mean, it's so dynamic and it's always in flux that, you know, to even talk about it sometimes is difficult because, you know, what you say today might be different tomorrow just based by who comes in and comes and goes and the kinds of people that are available and the kinds of sounds you can create.
Right. I wonder how different it is. Like when you first started composing and when you first start playing music, you kind of learn the structure of things. You learn cover songs and you start learning the theory of everything. And then at some point you kind of let that go and you just sort of go on your own. But we still do always kind of go back to structure at some point. And so I wonder if process is just discovering different kinds of structure each day, or if you're trying to just get rid of structure, if you're trying to avoid the process altogether, maybe your process could be getting rid of a process if that's possible.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, Glenn Gould described the fugue as a process about process, you know, it's about an idea that's always unfolding and being developed. And I think you're right. I think a lot of the way people can approach composition has to deal with their relationship to their own process. You know, I mean, it's always kind of a feeling of, at least for my own experience, sort of not incompleteness, but not being able to fully say what you want to say through the means you're currently doing it through. You know, I mean, I spent a lot of time trying to write highly formalized music that was also intensely expressive and romantic. And that was almost, it was a battle between the, you know, the logic I'm trying to construct for myself and what I just want to purely express. And it was almost, it was frustrating, you know? I mean, I'm still, you know, grounding or leaning towards not process-based things, but structured music. You know, my music isn't always through composed. Mm-hmm. I think partially because, you know, that structure, and especially the use of repetition, can kind of give meaning to things, at least give meaning to your musical ideas. Because if you repeat, you know, state one idea once and it doesn't come back, then what was the point in stating that idea? You know, it's just kind of, it might be a beautiful moment in itself. And indeed, that's kind of a way of composing. It's just writing moments and blocks. But for me, you know, I like hearing a familiar melody come back, especially after a long development, because that makes it that much more satisfying.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's that kind of, you know, I mean, this is that kind of expectation that's been built up in my ears over the years of social conditioning and studying the theory and analyzing form and, you know, having Western tonality ingrained in me from a very early age starts to, you know, you start to unconsciously expect 5-1 cadences pretty much in a lot of places.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, wrestling with your process is kind of just always trying to return to your true form, or at least trying to return to a process that's very true to yourself and what you have to say.
Right. It's like you spend a lot of time figuring out what that translator is, like you mentioned, for you, what you've got in your mind that you want to do, and then what you actually end up doing. There's the in-between there is like what you're trying to do. You're trying to connect the two. Can you get what's in your mind onto a piece of paper or onto a computer screen or whatever it is you're using? It's difficult. Yeah. And it changes.
It's extremely difficult, and it changes all the time. You know, I mean, I wrestled for years trying to write down exactly what I hear in my own head, even in the smallest detail, like just a couple of notes, you know, and that process of going from the head to the hand, you know, something changes probably along the way sometimes even, you know, and so, yeah. And sometimes even for the better, you know, you might be surprised what you come up with that you didn't even know you were going to say.
Yeah, definitely. It's a strange thing. And I don't know, sometimes I wonder if I've gotten better at it, or if I feel like I want to go back to a simpler time where it was just write and don't think about it so much and just do it. And you can go back and touch it up afterwards. I'm not sure if that's better than what I used to do. Like sometimes I used to think about it too much, analyze, overanalyze. And you, when does the revision ever end? I don't know if a piece ever ends, really. You could go back and revise things forever, indefinitely.
Yeah. I mean, Mahler was revising his symphony till the day he died. You know, I mean, yeah. I get it. He was a constant reviser, and I totally get it. And that's something I actually should do more of. If anything, my problem was I rushed to the double bar too quickly. You know, I had this idea in my head, and I had to really get it out really quickly and try to just be done with it. And then I would go back and listen to it and think of 100 things I should have done differently. So yeah. Even after the piece has been, you know, performed and out there. And so I'm just like, damn it, I shouldn't have rushed.
When we were talking about that video with Bert Whistle earlier, he mentioned something interesting at the beginning, or the interviewer did, about how when you spend 18 months working on a 20-minute piece, the disparity between the times there is interesting, because you've spent, in 18 months, you've gone through all these changes in life, not just in music. And is it, what kind of work is it that you're going for to create this 20-minute piece that took you a year and a half to create? It's like a collection of different pieces almost, because you have different perspectives and you have different thoughts about what sounds good or what sounds bad. And it's different. It's not just a collection. It's not just a work that was captured in one moment. It's like a collection of moments now, all of a sudden. You have to sort of like jumble that together.
Yeah. I mean, how do you assess a piece when you're not the same person when you finish it, when you were when you began it, because your criteria can completely change within that amount of time. Music is strange like that. You know, it's like you said, it's the disparity between the gestation period and the actual length of the piece is so often so strong that it, you know, this, you know, music exists almost in two different places and time. You know, it exists in the performance, in the duration of the performance, whether it's to say like a 20-minute piece for whatever. And it also exists outside of time in the notated page, you know, that you can look at any time for any amount of time, forwards or backwards, top or down, you know. And then it exists for that time that it's being written, you know? Yeah. And so you can't, it's almost intangible. You can't really point at the thing itself because, you know, the score is just the representation of the piece. The piece itself is, you know, only done through an act of performance, and that in itself is kind of an art, you know? And yeah. So that is sort of the medium for the thing, like the picture frame. And then the sketches and the process of writing it is just only the working out of it. So when you're done, it's like, well, where is the damn thing? <You
know? laughs> Where does it exist?
Where does it exist? It's like, where, you know, does it exist in, only in the performance and not before or after? Does it exist only on the page? And so it's weird like that. So, you know, time-based arts are extremely strange to think about if you kind of just stare at it for a little bit, you know?
Yeah, because it sort of involves time travel. I mean, you're talking about Beethoven back in the day is communicating. You and I can sit here and play any of his works that have been recorded. Mm-hmm. And we're basically communicating with him, or he's communicating with us from 200 years ago.
I know.
It's bizarre.
But that's also magic, the kind of the magical thing of it too. Definitely. No other art form can really do that, you know? I mean,
yeah.
At least not in the sense that what Beethoven is saying is being physically embodied in the performer, you know? I mean, yeah. We see paintings that are several hundred years old and you're interacting with something from that time, but you're not in the physical sense of like an actual performance. It's not coming through you. It's coming at you, you know? And so it's like an artist can, for lack of a better phrase, take control of your body at any time in history.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's like, if you're looking at a painting, it's just sort of there. It's not moving. It's not, there aren't any waves happening. It's just sort of like a dead object in some ways, but music is, you have all these different interpretations, and Glenn Gould played the Bach works way different than any other pianist might have, because he's got his own interpretation. He's got his foot on the pedal. He wants it to be like romantic.
That was his dialogue with Bach, you know, that was his relationship with Bach. And, you know, it transcended the time, you know, and more than anybody else as a performer, at least, kind of understood that dialogue that happens between performer and composer. You know, he was a composer himself, so he sympathized with composers and their intentions, you know, and so he looked at music from both sides of the coin. And so I think when he, you know, sat down with those pieces and everything, he really understood that it wasn't just, you know, interpreting notes on a page, but he was listening to the words of a very, very human person from, you know, the Baroque. And that kind of relationship really kind of transcended time and place. And so I think his understanding of that made his interpretations a little extra special.
And I think it works, to be honest. If you listen to it, I love it. If you look at a Bach piece, there aren't any markings on it. It doesn't, I mean, we can tell by the instruments that he had at the time what it might have sounded like, but maybe he wanted it to sound like how Glenn Gould was playing it.
Yeah, Glenn Gould turned the piano into harpsichord by the way he played it. I mean, it was incredible, you know. And I agree with you. I love the way, I can't listen to any of the Bach recordings now.
Right, yeah.
You
know? Yeah.
I mean, he kind of ruined it for me in that way. But
yeah,
there was nobody else like that. And I think nobody else understood that relationship, that atemporal relationship between composer and performer than Glenn Gould.
It's strange how you hear an interpretation, even if you're just listening to a CD. Like I have a Stravinsky's Rite of Spring recording, and I can't remember the symphony, but I have to listen to almost that one because I just loved it so much. And now I hear a different interpretation of it by Bernstein or somebody else, and I think, oh, I kind of like it the way that they did it, so now I get stuck on that, you know?
I do. Like Tree and I talk about this all the time. Like we have a problem because we get glued to a certain recording and interpretation, and we're like, "That's the one." Noah, you know, this is the way it should be performed every single time. And so whenever we hear a piece, you know, that we love live, we're super nervous because we don't know. You know, we're so invested in this one interpretation that nothing else will come up to snuff. You know, like we recently went and saw The Planets at the Oregon Symphony, and you know, we both love the Jupiter movement. And we both thought, like, we saw the extremes of interpretation within one piece, you know, during the outer sections, he took it way faster than the recording we normally listen to. So it was almost jarring and shocking. And then he took that slow middle anthemic section way slower than we were used to, too. And then, so in one performance, we got both ends of too fast, too slow. And yet, the expectation we had from that one recording was just, not met, but it was still a good performance. But yeah, we get stuck in this one view of the piece, and for better or worse.
It's hard to let go. I'll do that even with bands. Like if I have they release an album, and I used to think, oh, I want to hear it sound just like it sounds on the CD. But then when mm-hmm. you see really good bands in live, they go off of that, and it makes it so much better. But you don't. I always think at first going into it, like, I kind of want it to sound like how I know it. I know it this in this form. But if they make it better, it makes me think, well, you got to take that chance. It's not a Starbucks. It's not going to be like you're going to get the same thing every time. It's you win some, you lose some if you go off the rails or you try things. But it's worth mm-hmm. it sometimes, at least a percentage of the time. You get a better interpretation maybe.
Yeah, and it gets really interesting when you have bands like Radiohead who have a lot of electronic and studio manipulation on their tracks and trying to do a piece live, like Idiotech or Idiotic. I can't remember how it's pronounced.
Yeah,
it's such an electronic piece that Paul Lansky helped on, by the way, that, you know, when you hear it live, it's almost like a different tune entirely. The only thing that's really recognizable is the four chords and the drum beat, you know, and everything else is like almost completely acoustic. And so I don't know. It's tricky. It's, you know, especially when you get into electronic music and recreating that stuff live, you know, and there are so many like compositions that have interactive electronics where it's never the same the way the live, you know. Yeah. How do we build up an expectation that for a piece that's never the same way twice? You know, I think the only thing you can expect is the fact that it's not the same way twice.
Yeah.
And so you kind of have, it kind of forces you to adjust your expectations, you know, and reevaluate the way you listen to things in a way.
Probably to somebody who doesn't listen to classical music, they probably think that Beethoven symphonies sound the same every time performed, but there really is a great difference when you hear different symphonies or different conductors do them. I don't know if it's a greater difference than when you hear Radiohead or whatever band play different songs, but it feels like classical music has something unique there, because they have the tempo really changes everything. If you change tempos, you can interpret things. There's so many opportunities to change the piece in so many ways that I sometimes bands, it seems like, get stuck in playing those popular songs. They have to play the same ones over and over again. They have like a set list. Whereas with classical music, you kind of have a little bit more leeway sometimes in some pieces, depending on the period.
Well, yeah. And speaking of periods, it's like you can also get different intonation, you know, like we didn't tune by A440 for ever, you know? And so there's a great recording I'll send you on YouTube. It's the opening E flat chords to Beethoven's Symphony Number 3. And it's at, like, every recording since like the 50s. And it's just these two chords.
Thank you.
and they're all so different. It's just, you know, boom, boom, you know, right up front. And each time you hear it, you know, sometimes and this might be due to the fact that it's on a record spinning at different RPMs, but some are sharper than others, some are flatter than others, some are slightly faster or slower than the others. And, you know, it's 50 years of recordings in just a few minutes, and you can hear this wide spectrum of just these two chords.
Wow.
And so it's speaks to the infinite amount of variety you can do in an interpretation. Like you said, that it, like, people might think it's exactly the same way every time. It's definitely not. No. And it's definitely, you know, even in the most microcosmic, you know, levels can be wildly different depending on who's performing it and when they performed it.
Yeah, definitely. And the audience can shape it too. I mean, they want to hear different things, and the tastes have changed from what they were 100 years ago. It was a completely different scene. And it'd be interesting to think about where it's going. Cause you do see orchestral pieces now bringing in electronic aspects to works. So you've got like some sort of a merge between electronic composition and acoustic composition. And that's going to completely change it again, because you can get pretty much any tone you want with a computer. Whereas with an instrument, you can get different tones, but to get some of those microtones or combine tones or shape them and crush them and condense them, it makes almost anything possible.
Well, yeah, the electronic component has infinitely expanded the, you know, our sonic palette, you know. It's really encouraging, I think, to see orchestras reach into the multimedia realm. I mean, even if it's something as simple as playing film scores alongside, you know, the live movie, the live film. You know, one of the best Oregon Symphony shows I ever saw was them playing Psycho with the score live. Wow. It was so cool. And expanding that, you know, capability, I think, really makes it more than just what it once was. You know, I mean, the orchestra has always been evolving. It was just, you know, in Haydn's time, it was just, you know, a couple of wind instruments and a few strings. And now by the time it got to Mahler, it was, you know, 1,000 people. And then now we're starting to see more video, more film, even some dancers, you know. And I think as these things evolve, as we incorporate more electronics, more multimedia, we're just going to start seeing the orchestra evolve into its next thing, whatever that may be. You know, I mean, unconventional instruments are practically the norm now in orchestral writing, you know. Maybe
it could be one of those things where it's definitely going to change, and the change happens at the pace that it happens, which can take decades, whether you're talking about music or politics or anything. It feels in the moment like it's taking forever, but it's probably moving at the speed that's normal or fast, maybe.
Well, you know, it's another temporal disparity, like between the music and performance and the music on the page. You know, it's easy for us to look at the music on the page and the timeline and see, oh yeah, these change happens at X amount of intervals. You know, but now we're here in the moment and, you know, experience time in real time. You know, it's like we are only seeing things change at the rate that they're going to unfold, you know, so it's difficult to step back and try to predict where it's going to go. But it's a very interesting moment. And I think I'm really excited to see where these orchestras go. Hopefully they don't all become museums. You know, I want them to be like living ensembles just as much as, you know, chamber ensembles. And I think it has the power to really be, you know, like what it once was. It used to be the central entertainment for the time. It was the movie theater, you know, and now it's sort of a museum. But I think if we allow, or at least hope, encourage these ensembles to embrace new forms of technology, new ways of writing, new ways of reproducing and creating sound, that kind of change will really start to become embodied. You know, and we were talking about this, you know, earlier about our cities and stuff too. You know, change is going to happen whether we want to or not. And the best thing we can do is adapt and try to make the best of it. And so I'm hoping that the standard repertoire doesn't gentrify the orchestra.
It could be that the devices and the tools that we have too are just, they've changed or progressed faster than humans are able to process it. So we've got the symphony is still basically the same. I mean, it's different than it was 100 years ago, but it's a lot of the elements are still there, but eventually when you have new generations come up and they're used to having computer music, or they're used to having electronic compositions around, it'll probably change into something that fits that time or that generation or the people that are the audience that's sitting there listening to it. It'll just reflect what people are in the mood for, what they like.
Yeah. I mean, technology is developing exponentially quickly. And so it's understandable that there's a challenge to keep up, you know, but I think as people evolve and orchestras evolve and technology evolves, that it's going to kind of coalesce in some way. I mean, it has to. It's, you know, adapt or die in the music world. And so I want to see something that I would personally love to see something that's just so fundamental and so ingrained in our culture to survive. You know, I mean, I still love listening to orchestral music, even the classics.
Me too. Yeah.
And, there's still a place for that. I think as long as we continue to evolve, let ourselves evolve while still maintaining a dialogue with the past, it will inform our future.
It'd be interesting to be a fly on the wall in some of the orchestral upper echelons of different orchestras and just see what they're talking about. Are they aware of the changes that are happening, or are they constantly seem to be talking about how they can get more people involved in their organizations, whether it's just participation by going to concerts, or if it's like people donating, or if they're actually enthusiastic about it. I would hope that it would reflect what we're talking about in that there are changes that are happening, but it doesn't mean you have to destroy the past. I mean, what would be the point of being a composer saying, forget all the old stuff, that's old, just play the new stuff? Because then eventually you're going to get replaced yourself if you have that attitude. So you want it all to sort of work together harmoniously.
Yeah. I mean, I would be curious to hear that as well. I mean, at the end of the day, I think some people treat it like a business, you know, and profit is king in business. You know, unfortunately, that's the system we're in right now. It's, you know, so we got to be able to get people in the seats. And, you know, I know there are a lot of orchestras that have a lot of interesting outreach efforts, whether it be educational, you know, sending musicians to elementary schools and just, you know, getting them excited about the music and kind of planting seeds that way. There are art ensembles that do the film and music thing. There are ensembles that will take, you know, subgroupings of their orchestra and do new music ensembles like Fear No Music and Third Angle. You know, those are comprised of pretty much all organ symphony musicians. Yep. Some places are still doing the standards. You know, I think I saw this study that Nate Silver put out. It was about the Met Opera and the operas they produce, and they basically came to the conclusion that they perform the same four operas in cycle for over and over and again, because that's the way brings people, you know. I mean, that's just kind of, but you know, it kind of for me raises the question, is like, well, is that what people want to see, or is that what people are expecting to see after you do it for so long? You know, it's like, oh, the Met's doing another performance of, you know, the Ring Cycle again, we should go check it out. You know, they're so good at it. Yeah. We expect them to do something like that, so we're you know, not surprised and kind of, you know, almost comforted by the familiarity.
Right. It's also the one thing that classical music has, and that I think rock music or whatever will run into eventually, is that the catalog is so huge. So it's like, how do you get through it? Even, yeah, they're repeating the Ring Cycle, or they're always playing Verdi's Aida, or the Magic Flute. They could be expanding, but even if they did expand it and they did a different concert or a different opera every week, they still wouldn't even touch like the catalog, like the, all the works that exist out there that are great, with not even counting the new stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the trickier questions to answer, is like, what will persist over and through time? And I think that just kind of boils down to, I don't have an answer for you. I couldn't tell you why history chooses what it does, but maybe it just has to be, you know, played a lot. I mean, there are plenty of pieces that get played a lot that aren't very good, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, definitely. And that's, in some ways, I don't know how that works. So the process for orchestras or opera is different than, you know, a concert of a string quartets or a smaller ensemble for concerts. But yeah, I don't know how you integrate the two. I mean, the new works, clearly there's a lot of great composers who don't get a lot of play. and they should. And I don't know how you balance the two of those. Maybe people are getting better at it. I don't know.
Well, there's always the element of risk too. I mean, you know, like I said earlier, some people treat this these things like a business. And if they're going to risk revenue on a new work that may or not be good, you know, for an audience that they feel like they understand pretty well, then why would they risk, you know, playing Death of Klingon for an audience that loves Aida, you know? And so that could be one reason why some things don't get the credit that they're due. I mean, you know, I remember when I was a student at PSU, I was talking with one of the opera teachers there, and I was asking why aren't you doing like Dr. Atomic this year? This is a great opera. And they're like, well, would that bring people? And I'm just like, yeah, I can tell you, for, you know, I know a bunch of students who would be interested in an opera about, you know, Oppenheimer. I would love to see that. I've never seen it live, and I really wanted to. And it would be, personally for me, super refreshing to see something like that, because it would mean that they're actually somewhat relevant, these opera companies or these symphonies or whomever is, you know, relying on the war horses of the repertoire. So,
and you wouldn't know if you didn't play it.
You wouldn't know if you wouldn't play it. And, you know, I think, you know, honestly, I think a lot of people underestimate people who would come to these things if you actually were like, hey, this is a work by a living composer. You know, we're going to be playing Songbird Song by John Luther Adams this weekend, and who recently won the Pulitzer for this Become Ocean, you know, that Taylor Swift endorsed, you know. So it's like, you can, I think, you know, the allure of the new is not old. I think, you know. Yeah, or not new, I should say. So I think a lot of people are just underestimating their audiences.
Yeah, and they probably would be into. I think people would definitely be into that if it. I mean, people go to art museums for new works, living artists and stuff, and they go. People go see films, new films. Exactly. So I mean, classical music kind of has a stigma attached to it that it's a crowd that. You know, they just are drinking champagne and tuxes, and we don't think of it that way, but it could be that it exists somewhere in society in a lot of places.
It's, you know, I've heard that a lot. You know, a lot of people are intimidated by the classical concert hall because they just don't feel like they know enough about it. You know, they don't feel like they feel like they probably need like a music degree to be able to appreciate the music. And, you know, I always tell everyone, just like, just close your eyes and listen, you know, that's all you need to do. Just let your mind, let the music come through you. Like you would any sort of band you love, you know, it's not really anything different. The only thing different is the place it's happening and the people who are playing it and the people who wrote it, you know, but it's the same in a way, you know, it's at its core, the same kind of experience, you know, you're there to take in the air. And I think if we can reframe these institutions in such a way that they don't have to be so intimidated, and that they are still culturally relevant, that they are still engaged with, you know, in a dialogue of the now, that people would definitely still be just as interested in it as they were before. I mean, it's just all about how you present it. And I think the classical world has a big bad image problem. You know, people associate this stuff with Lexus commercials and everything fancy and rich and elitist and black tie. And when it's, you know, back in the day, you know, the people were listening to Beethoven symphonies on dirt floors while, you know, drinking beer.
Yeah, that presentation's a key word there, I think, because the way it's presented does pose a problem. I think it's a fixable problem. If that's your biggest problem is just how you present it, I think that's probably a good thing, because you can fix it if you want to. And some people are doing that, where you take it out of the concert hall and you go into, you know, you can go Pioneer Square, you play some music, or you go into malls or outside bookshops or whatever, and you just start playing music in subways or, and people can interact with it. Then they don't have to interact with it in a concert hall where they kind of feel like they're not part of that society. Like there's going to be a test or something afterwards and how much they're paying attention. So that sort of the space that it's presented could be a huge thing.
And there are groups like, you know, Classical Revolution who are presenting, music in bars. You know, there are people like Portland Cello on Project that are doing covers and crossover, you know, doing Elliott Smith covers, and really, they've got a big fan base just purely by doing, you know, cello arrangements of popular songs, Taylor Swift and Kanye West, you know? I mean, so I think I think if, you know, I don't want to say crossover is the way to go, but like you said, presentation is half the battle. And I think, you know, presenting something that's very familiar, like a cello arrangement of a Kanye West song alongside, you know, a great Beethoven string quartet introduces you to that world, or it can be a way to kind of bridge the gap and introduce people to that world. You know, it's like, start with what's familiar and represent it in an interesting new way. And then alongside something that is, you know, standard for that world as well. So that way you have something familiar to get your foot through the door and kind of get introduced to that world, you know?
Yeah.
It does boil down to a lot of presentation for sure.
Hopefully it won't be something that just dies because people didn't want to take a chance. So like most art museums don't really operate on their own ticket sales. They kind of get funding because even in the US where arts funding is pretty terrible, they do give a lot of money to museums to keep them open, and they wouldn't be able to function, a lot of them, on ticket sales. Some like the Matt Might or MoMA. But what happens if you get to a point where that funding is cut off, or I mean, how many orchestras have gone under in the last 50 to 70 years or so? I mean, that almost forces you to behave in a way that you wouldn't, that doesn't really complement what you're trying to do. So like, I've seen you post things about how you have to be a composer and you have to work at Staples, or you have to be an artist and you have to work at McDonald's, because, and now all of a sudden you're doing things that really have nothing to do with the work that you're trying to produce.
Yeah. Yeah. There's these weekly, discussions that happen on Twitter under the hashtag of MusoChat that talk about a lot of things like this. There was one session we had about defining what is success. And, you know, I think, David Rakowski jumped in at one point and asked, well, was when Feldman and Reich and Glass were driving cabs, were they successful? You know, I mean, these, you know, some of the biggest names in the composers in the world still had day jobs. I mean, Charles Ives sold insurance, for God's sakes, for years, and nobody knew he was a composer until after he died, practically, you know. And so it's a struggle, you know, and with, you know, arts funding being what it is in this country, you're going to have to do what you're going to have to do. And, you know, to maybe it's just my bitter side talking, but to parade around as if being, you know, solely subsidized by your music is the only form of success, I think just utter bullshit. You know, I mean, people have to do what they have to do, and they're going to have to hustle. And, you know, some people are going to have more luck than others. You know, two equally talented people might have different opportunities, and we'll give them two different careers, despite having, you know, both having, you know, high levels of talent and a lot to say, you know? And so, I mean, it's not unusual. I mean, composers have had a lot of different things to do in addition to being composers. I mean, Beethoven is probably the most famous freelancer in history. And he was very unusual that way, you know. I mean, most people were Kapellmeister, you know, or
court composers or whatever.
Court composers, you know, writing for the emperor, or the modern form of that would be working at academia now, you know, being a university composer. And so, I don't know. I think it's all just part of that adaptation thing, you know. You know, your success is going to be defined by your own criteria. And as long as you are being honest with yourself and your process and the work you come up with, I don't think you can do wrong. You know,
it's interesting that the professor positions in music departments have become court composing, because they've got these positions. They can have graduates do their, some of their work in regard to class time or, some of the coursework, and then they can sit and write. But I don't know. I feels like I used to think that the academic world had such influence, but maybe it's just because I'm not associated with it anymore. But it feels like that's eroding a little bit.
I think you're right. I mean, music programs are becoming smaller and smaller in a lot of universities too. So, I mean, funding for these things is struggling just like anywhere else. And, you know, I think the peak of the university composer was like, you know, during that serialist avant-garde nightmare that we went through. And I'm kidding, stuff there. But I think, you know, the when Babbitt was like at the height of his powers and doing those kind of work, and you know that when composers were started thinking about themselves as scientists, along as well as being artists, is where you know the golden age of university composer kind of came in and went. But it's still happening, and I think you know if you can do that, then more power to you.
It's definitely still happening, but I feel like it peaked with the Roger Sessions era and all that. Like everybody sort of moved beyond that. I think in part because of technology, and it's probably happening in different genres of music too, because you can produce your own stuff. You don't need to go through a record company. You don't have to sign a record deal. You can get everything on iTunes or Amazon or sell it on your website or whatever. So you can kind of bypass all those once. They're still powerful institutions, but they probably have less power now that the individual is empowered through technology, through the web and everything.
Absolutely. I mean, big record labels are going by the wayside now, and everyone's recording in their bedrooms and releasing stuff on their website. And, you know, I'm trying to do that myself, too. You know, I think the development of technology has democratized opportunities in a way. I mean, you know, we have the internet at our disposal, which is the greatest publication tool there is, you know. Why would I need to sign over the rights to my music and to a publisher and have them do the PR work for me when I can just invest a few thousand dollars in gear, record stuff at my own house, use the internet to teach myself, and use the internet to distribute it and send it anywhere in the world for free? You know, why would I want to give up the majority of my rights and royalties for something like that? You know, I think it's at this point, you know, it's unless you're famous enough, there really is no reason to go to a major publisher.
Yeah.
And so I think the development of technology has really, you know, equaled the playing field in a way. You know, if anything, right now, we're the biggest challenge for today's composers is breaking through the noise and trying to get yourself heard, because so many people have a much more equal opportunity to this. And it's a great thing because it has really relieved us of the kind of artistic expectations that we normally have. Like, we don't have common practice anymore. You know, because, you know, there aren't as many finite number of composers working in a similar vacuum. We now have, you know, these composers that I can listen to, you know, anywhere in the world, writing in styles that I could never even dreamed of, and really kind of creating a very rich musical landscape for us to tap into and listen to and be influenced by.
It's going to be interesting to see what happens, because I was listening to a podcast today with Dane Cook and Greg Fitzsimmons, and they were saying how Greg Fitzsimmons asked him, how do you connect with people nowadays? Because it's your technology. And he kept saying, you have to be in people's pockets, because people don't even really want to go to your website anymore. They don't give a shit. They don't want to go to YouTube. You know, if somebody posts a YouTube video online on Twitter or Facebook, most people don't click on it. They're not really going to do, unless it's like a puppy doing something interesting or a cat doing something funny. But like, so I wonder how you get into people's pockets as a composer. Is it, you have to have some sort of direct connection? Like, how do you do that?
Write pieces with clickbaity titles.
I guess. Yeah.
Like, won't believe what these five notes did next.
I think that's a new piece. We should each do a piece called,
there we go. We'll just do the clickbait suite.
Yeah. I don't know how you, because sort of what we're doing, and this goes back to the piece that the string quartet that you wrote that we were talking about. It's not a soundbite. So if you can have a comedy or a comedian can just throw a joke at you really quickly, if it's in your pocket, you look at it, you get a notification. Oh, you laugh. But how do you be in somebody's pocket for a 10-minute piece? Because that requires them listening and paying attention.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Maybe you can't.
You can't. It's like, you can't sum up that stuff. It's like, it's like trying to, you know, compress a whole book into somebody's pocket, you know, or even compress a novella of some kind, you know, too. You know, I mean, we live in a time where short form information is, you know, prioritized. We have Vine, which is 6-second loops, and Twitter, which is 140 character limit, you know? So these are micro pieces of information. And, I mean, unless we start writing like musical miniatures that are like 10 seconds long, you know, I mean, I guess we could all specialize in ringtones. That might, you know, help us, you know, That's the only quickest way I can think of to get somebody's pocket.
The ringtone. Somebody's going to hear this maybe, and the ringtone composer is going to go big.
Yeah. Well, we can open up a new genre of new ringtone.
Micro symphonies and mini mini quartets and mini works.
5 second symphony.
Well, you could probably, I don't know. You could probably compress long works into 5 seconds and it would produce an interesting sound. If you had like an hour work, if you could find a way to compress it without changing the tone of it too much, the register of it, it would be a completely different piece, but maybe that'll become a huge thing. I don't know.
I mean, I've heard a lot of some funny things on like SoundCloud where people will take some pieces and stretch them out like 1,000-fold and super slow them down too. So, and it's almost like this ambient soundscape, you know, you'll be listening to like one measure of Mahler 5 for like 20 minutes. And, you know, this is sort of the opposite of what direction we're going in, but like it becomes almost something else entirely. And I'm wondering now, what would it be like to like compress Beethoven 7 into like 5 seconds and what that would sound like?
The Stockhausen gave a speech, Karlheinz Stockhausen it was in Oxford, and he was talking about how you could take Beethoven's 9th symphony and compress it into like, so it was just like 1 second, just like boop. Mm-hmm. And if you could keep it to where it didn't lose its register, he would be inventing a new tone. Like it would be composed of like an hour's worth of work compressed into one moment, so that it would have all this different color. And then you could just get maybe 12 other tones like that. And all of a sudden you're dealing with a palette that's composed of these tones that have never existed before.
It's out there. Stockhausen was out there like that for sure.
He also thought he was from another universe, I think, or some other.
Yeah, or he was from the star Sirius, right?
Sirius.
He was an alien, which I would believe entirely.
It could be, yeah. I mean, I don't know how you come up with an idea like that, but it could be. Maybe he's already done it. Maybe in the other galaxy or star system or whatever. Maybe they're doing that already, trying to to where we're at.
I mean, that's another level of temporal manipulation that we're even talking about. You know, we talked about the score, then performance, and now we're taking the performance and manipulating that. So it's like you can just endlessly take another layer, you know, it can go on recursively, endlessly like that, I guess. But
you can, like the person who took those, the 20 minute, the recording of the crickets. Do you remember that, where they stretched it out over 20 minutes and it sounded like a beautiful chorus?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's something like that, or the reverse of that. And it was really interesting because they just took it and spread it out over the course of 20 minutes and it sounded fantastic. Completely different than crickets.
Yeah.
So we're talking about manipulation, and maybe that's not everybody's cup of tea, but it's interesting. Well, and, you know, all of it sort of requires an attention span, which the point is, if you're in somebody's pocket, you're not going to like pull it out and get that experience, I don't think.
No, I think, and, you know, at some point too, it's like, you gotta just let the piece be what it's going to be. I mean, trying to compress, you know, an hour's worth of music into somebody's pocket is going to be no easy order. And I think just kind of going back to presenting it such a way that's just, you know, enticing. I mean, I couldn't tell you. It's a difficult question.
Thank you. Thanks for listening. What you're hearing is the sound of two tracks. Crickets at normal speed, and then crickets stretched out over a long period of time, though, so that it sounds almost like a human chorus. Listen to that. Now, there is some controversy about whether this is an authentic recording. That people have tried to reproduce this, I guess, and they couldn't. So there's a bit of an issue with potentially adding in some music to this to make it sound a little more beautiful than it might, or, you know, there might be some lying going on here, but I don't know that. I'm not going to accuse anybody of that. Either way, I think it's an interesting idea, so I'm playing it, and, you know, it's nice. I think it's nice. It's crickets, man. What else do you want? They could just be beautiful on their own, like birds. I love birds. It's early March right now in Michigan, and it's warm. It's like in the 60s for the next week and a half, and the birds are loving it. I mean, they are chirping away. It's like, they're like the Beatles out there, just singing all day long, letting us have it. And I think conjuring up spring and the warm weather and the flowers. I think when the flowers hear the birds, they start to pull towards them. Does that make any sense, or am I too high? I'm not high, but maybe it's just like Everbuzz, like I'm always high. Maybe I'm having a flashback, but it sounds like something that could happen in my twisted world. This show is brought to you by people who sometimes could pay for ads at the beginning of the podcast. It hasn't happened yet, but let me just extend this offer. Since I'm trying to connect with businesses or companies that will sponsor the show and in return get promotion, this show is doing pretty well. I mean, if you want to know the numbers, just email me and I'll tell them to you. But I'll tell you this, it's doing way better than I thought it would. But while I'm working on sponsors, what about this? If you're an artist or you have a project or you sell something on Etsy, am I saying that right? Etsy or whatever else. And you want to just throw some cash or some money and be a sponsor, and I can mention your ad and we can work it out. Just email me. Let's do it that way. Let's go the local route or the entrepreneur route, right? I don't mean to say lower, but you know what I mean. Like there's Target, and then there's somebody who owns like a bakery in a part of the town that's just local, and it's the only one, and it's beautiful, and people go in there, but they don't have the same budget, and maybe they want to bring in some business. Or if you're just a person who makes buttons, this could I really think I've got a big button following. So just shoot me an email. Let's talk about that, and then we can discuss what needs to happen to make that happen. It's a lot of happenings. Help me help you sell buttons. Anyway, so if you go to arthouse43.com, you go to troymeetsworld.com, you click on donate, and then you can send us some resources. We need your support. Creative projects are never free, so any support you could give would be greatly appreciated. It is nice to be back. I am sorry about the technical issues. I am here, I am ready, and I am going to pump out some podcasts. I think I'm going to do two this week just to catch up from last week. Who knows? Maybe I'll do one every day. I actually started another podcast called Troy Meets World. It's on Spreaker, like speaker, but with an R, Spreaker.com. It was okay. It was okay. But, I was just trying to fill the podcast void in my life. There was a big podcast hole, and I just wanted to shovel some useless Troy stuff into it. And that's what happened. And I did two episodes, about a half an hour each. So technically, I was doing podcasts. I just didn't do them in the traditional art house format. But art house is back. It's stronger than ever. Can you feel it? Can you feel the power of art house? You were so down last week. You were walking around listening to Mazzy Star and Radiohead, and you're like, life sucks, man. Art house is dead. I can't believe Troy died. Oh, man. People were like, where's Troy? And you're like, he died. He's dead. And they're like, what happened? I'm like, I don't know. He just died. But I'm not dead, motherfucker. I'm here. I'm alive. Just let's pretend that I'm back from the dead. Maybe somebody can get this going. Podcast host Troy Ramos killed in a freak accident. Host of Art House Radio was walking down the street, blah, 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 and then I'm back. I faked my own death, only I didn't fake it. This is going on way too long. Listen, thank you for listening. I appreciate it. Thank you, Americans. Thank you, Canadians. The Danes. The Danish or the Danes? Germans, obviously. New Zealanders. Australians. I see that you guys are all downloading the podcast. I love it. Just send me some sort of questions or interact with me at Spanish Peanuts. You can find me on Facebook, Arthouse43. I don't know, it's like facebook.com/arthouse43, something like that. And by the way, this is Arthouse Radio, which is a, I don't know if subsidiary is the right word, but Arthouse 43 is an arts organization, and Arthouse Radio is a baby that was birthed by Arthouse 43. So that's why all the stuff is arthouse43.com or at arthouse43. That works too. Just get in touch with me. Thank you for listening. I want you to enjoy your day. Appreciate it. You could be dead tomorrow. So, I mean, don't go nuts. I don't want you to like empty your bank account and start smoking meth. Don't do that. I just mean stop and enjoy the moment. We don't know what this is. We don't know where we're going. We don't know how long we'll be here. So go up to that person that you wanted to talk to, you know, make that dinner that you've been thinking about making. Just make it happen. All right. Until next time, friends.